One of the things I'm really going to focus on in this presentation is something that Helen raised, which is the ethical question of can you trust what you are told, the issue of asymmetries of information in this consumer market. And I want to make explicit at the beginning, because it might not be clear from some of my provocative questions earlier in the day, I do actually think it is okay to offer genetic susceptibility testing direct to consumer. But I do believe that the market needs tighter regulation. I've had the opportunity over the last 5 years of research to talk to a number of companies that are in the space, that were coming into the space. And when you talk to direct-to-consumer genetics companies, you hear three messages from all of them. And the first message is, they think they're offering good tests and an ethical service. And the second message is they think some of their competitors are offering bad tests and unethical services. And the third thing is they would like some regulation to sort out the bad players. Okay, so this all stems from a project led by David Meltzer, funded by the Wellcome Trust in Cambridge, where we were looking at the policy issues and the evaluation of genetic tests for common diseases. This project started about 5 years ago, and so we were in some senses ahead of the curve, although with the APOE4 and Alzheimer's, etc., really the kind of well-established issues. And we were looking at the issues of how do we ensure that doctors, patients and healthcare systems have good quality data on tests to make informed decisions. And we're looking at the regulatory framework and also the incentives needed to generate high quality data. We did research in Europe, North America, talked to people in Australia, stakeholders from people from all stakeholder groups, including industry, and have gone backwards. And coming out of that, we've done a lot of policy engagement. So we've engaged directly with the regulators in Europe, with the European Commission. We've engaged very strongly with the Human Genetics Commission on the regulation of consumer genetic testing. We participated in the drafting of OECD guidelines on quality assurance and molecular genetic testing. We, with other colleagues who are interested in these issues, have sent in responses to consultations on the FDA's guidance on regulation of IVD MIAs, to the Global Harmonisation Task Force, models for risk classification and conformity assessment that are likely to influence future regulation in Europe. And we provided written and oral evidence to House of Lords Inquiry in Genomic Medicine. So we have tried to kind of influence policy, as well as doing a whole host of academic publications, most of which you can get, well, all of which I'll be happy to share with you. So I think there are three problems. And the first problem, from the point of view of regulatory concerns, is problems with the tests. And this really is irrelevant whether it's direct to consumer or not. A bad test, a test that tests for SNPs that actually don't have a validated gene disease association, whether it's offered through a doctor, whether it's not offered through a doctor, it's irrelevant. It's giving misleading information. And the second issue with the test is how much evidence is enough to justify clinical use. Second problem is problem with services. What is the appropriate standard of care? Is pre and post test counselling that we think of as necessary for clinical genetics, necessary for susceptibility testing or PGX testing? So is it the same for all tests? And then we've got problems with promotion. How do we ensure that claims are justified by the scientific evidence, don't mislead consumers, and should we restrict direct consumer advertising? So I'm going to talk about how this fits into the existing regulatory landscape. In particular, I'm going to focus on, in terms of regulation of tests, the regulation of in vitro diagnostics as medical devices, and the regulation of clinical laboratories. In relation to the regulation of services, I'm going to focus on the governance framework for genetic testing, so practice guidelines and codes of practice. And the regulation of promotion, again, will come out through some of these things that I'm going to focus on. I'm not going to talk about consumer law or advertising codes. So I think we need to put this in context. We've had a fairly lengthy debate over the last decade or so about the need to enhance the regulation of genetic testing. DTC genetics has just recently become a focus for that debate. And that debate has highlighted fundamental flaws in the regulatory framework from vitro diagnostics. And just to give you an example, interview with a US company about the regulations for in vitro diagnostic devices and their views on them. And again, just to set this in context, DTC genetics is a tiny part of genetic testing, and genetic testing is a tiny part of the in vitro diagnostic sector. There are much bigger regulatory issues at stake here. Also, I want to be absolutely clear that regulation does not mean prescription. Regulation does not mean banning. Regulation involves standard setting, monitoring, and enforcement. Okay, I think there's far too much in policy debate at the moment where regulation is simply conflated with banning things, and it's really unhelpful. This is very important. I've already suggested that industry act as gatekeepers. The state is not the only actor with regulatory capacities. Not only industry, professional bodies, non-governmental organisations have a key role to play in both standard setting and often in enforcement of standards. And finally, a point that I've made several times already today about gatekeepers, and I'm not going to labour the point because I'm sure you're bored with it by now. Okay. The policy debate at the moment has kind of picked up on several issues that I just want to briefly address. Are we overreacting? Are we acting too soon? Can we really regulate a global market through nation states? And are we indulging in genetic exceptionalism? Are we overreacting? Do we really want to put in place clinical standards from clinical genetics about pre and post-test counselling for susceptibility testing? I don't think one size fits all, but I do think that there are minimum standards that should apply to all tests. And then to decide where we need to apply stricter standards requires, one, a system for risk classification to decide, A, which tests should be subject to pre-market review and how stringent that review is, and B, which tests should require medical consultation. And there may be some linkage between those two things. And secondly, we need a responsive approach to regulation which can identify and punish bad players. If we look at DECODE and we have a little inspection of their systems and everything and decide we think they're acting in a responsible way, we may decide that we're going to be slightly less stringent in our regulation of them, and we're going to focus more heavily on the companies that we think are not doing a good job. Are we acting too soon? The policy debate about the regulation of genetic testing has been going on for over a decade. I would suggest that there's widespread agreement on key issues now enshrined in international standards such as the OECD guidelines on quality assurance for molecular labs. Companies have been offering direct-to-consumer genetic tests since at least 1995. University Diagnostics offered CF testing in the UK. The market is growing, but I would suggest there are no new issues on the table. And some ELSI researchers have been working on this extensively. It's not just people I've been involved with. Genetics and Public Policy Centre in the United States, Bryn Williams-Jones in Canada, and some other people in Canada as well. There has really been a lot of thought about these issues. Can nation states regulate a global market? I would suggest it's not actually a global market. There are very few firms actually trying to operate globally, and many firms are respecting national or state regulations. I've spoken to US companies and I've said to them, why aren't you selling your tests in the UK? And they say, oh, well, it's illegal, isn't it? And I say, well, no, there's no legal impediment to you selling your tests in the UK. So companies are often trying to respect what they think are national regulations. Also, the internet is not a regulation-free space, but state action may not be sufficient, and again, there may be a role for non-governmental organisations in establishing international standards. Colin Scott has written a very interesting article about regulatory innovation and online consumer, which I recommend to you. Are we indulging in genetic exceptionalism? I would suggest that sometimes genetic exceptionalism is not a bad thing. If you look at the UK genetic testing network, it's driven up standards for molecular genetic testing in the UK. It's looked on as a model elsewhere in the globe. If we'd stopped and said, oh dear, this is genetic exceptionalism, we should apply it to the whole of pathology in the National Health Service, we would never have done the UK genetic testing network. Sometimes from a pragmatic point of view, genetic exceptionalism is appropriate. I would also suggest that this is an exceptional issue because we have a new business model in the in vitro diagnostics industry. Traditionally, you would discover a biomarker, there would be a gradual accretion of evidence through research, a filtering, a kind of ambiguous phase of research through to early clinical use, all done by lab directors and doctors. Then you might see commercialisation of test kits. Again, gradual accretion of understanding of clinical relevance of the test. And maybe somewhere 10, 15 years down the line, consumer kits would be produced if there's market potential in that application. Our new business model, by utilising the fact that the SNPs are already on the chips that we have, Web 2, that you can collect the swab the spit very easily, has bypassed all that. So this is an exceptional market. And so I want to talk about largely asymmetries of information, how we level the playing field, and the role of IVD device regulations in doing that. IVD device regulations can ensure pre-market review of analytic and clinical validity. Unlike Helen, I don't think they should review clinical utility unless the company is making strong clinical utility claims. They can set clear evidence standards for market entry. They can monitor performance in the post-market environment. And most importantly, they can ensure truth in labelling and truth in promotion. They cannot, however, deal with ethical social issues such as genetic discrimination, the issues of informed consent, or evaluate clinical utility, I would suggest. Okay, what's wrong with the European regulations? Most tests in Europe, whether they're genetic or not, are classed as low risk, so there is no independent pre-market review, and we are the only regulatory system in kind of the Western world that has this bizarre situation. Laboratory developed tests, or you might know them as homebrew tests. Commercial LDTs are classed as medical devices, but interpretation and enforcement of this varies across member states. Given that we're talking about a market that's all about commercial LDTs, that is an issue. There are issues around the implications of regulating LDTs as medical devices that haven't been thought through. So what is the product label for something like a DECO-ME test? And then laboratory-developed tests performed outside the European Union are not covered by the directive, so the MHRA and the European Commission says. In fact, the directive doesn't really address the issue, so I would suggest an absence of explicit discussion of these tests doesn't in fact preclude you regulating them, and certainly the FDA has taken the stance that in principle they could regulate such tests in the US. There's discussion about whether it covers clinical validity or just analytic validity, and we have no guidance and standards, largely because most tests are classed as low risk. The good news is the European Commission wants to tighten the regulations, and they had a public consultation last year about this issue, and these are just some of the things that are on the table still at the moment. The dialogue is ongoing. If you feel strongly about these issues, do get in touch with DG Enterprise. They're very open to all new ideas at the moment. And adoption of a new risk classification system is one of their ideas, and that would mean that genetic tests would be subject to pre-market review along with a whole slew of other tests that we might consider certainly at least moderate risk. Now, very briefly talk about the situation in the US. In the US, genetic tests are treated as class 2 or class 3, usually class 2, so that means there is a pre-market review of their analytic and their clinical validity. The FDA probably has the most robust system for the regulation of in vitro diagnostic devices in the world. And its problem really has been that traditionally the FDA haven't regulated laboratory developed tests. That situation is likely to change, but that really is the big loophole in the USA. And certainly those industry people who make kits rather than laboratory developed tests often argue that there should be a greater equality. And in relation to this, what we've seen, Secretary Advisory Committee on Genetic Testing in 2000 recommended FDA step up to the plate in relation to this. FDA started to make some moves in that direction, plans for a lab registry and so forth. Basically, politics intervened. George Bush got elected, some really quite regulation-like people got put into senior posts at FDA. The Secretary Advisory Committee was disbanded and the FDA retreated. Events do matter in this space. What we've seen subsequently is that the FDA has been intervening on an ad hoc basis, and basically the thing that kind of unites all these tests is they're cancer tests, they're all polygenic, and they all involve an interpretative algorithm to get a risk score. And the algorithm is proprietary because it's a laboratory developed test. So having intervened on the case-by-case basis in these 2 years, FDA then issued a draft guidance saying these kinds of tests, tests for serious conditions, where there's a proprietary interpretive algorithm, we are going to regulate as medical devices. There was a lot of unhappiness about FDA's new direction. Quite a lot of politics going on. Because the presidential election was happening, everything effectively got stalled. But in the meantime, the new Secretary's Advisory Committee, again recommended, about the fifth time some august body in the US in the last 15 years has made these kinds of recommendations, that the FDA should take on laboratory-developed tests and some other interesting recommendations that I can't go into. Given that our new American President Obama introduced into the Senate, when he was still a senator, a bill on personalised medicine, which included calls for greater regulation of the space, specifically addressing this regulatory issue, it's highly likely that we will see resolution of the FDA's position on laboratory developed tests, I would suggest, in the next 2 years, although it will take time to write a new rule. In doing so, FDA have got some issues because they have a gold standard of pre-market review, and if they're looking at a whole lot more tests, then how do they maintain that gold standard given limited regulatory resources? Are they going to have to lower that standard? There are other options and some very interesting industry proposals about new regulatory pathway, a test registry, again a kind of regulation by information disclosure kind of concept, or revising risk classification to take basically things that are very well established out of the kind of class 2 class so that FDA can concentrate on new and unknown quantities. Okay, so I'm going to talk about regulation of services briefly. OECD guidelines on quality assurance for molecular genetic testing 2007, Council of Europe additional protocol on genetic testing 2008, UK initiatives on direct consumer genetics from the code of practice that Jonathan referred to, which is in fact no longer in operation, but they keep on the website, which is probably why these US companies are confused. So what we've seen in Europe is this new additional protocol on genetic testing that I'll talk about briefly, an ETAG technology assessment report on direct consumer testing, which was reported to European Parliament, presented to the Parliament in 2009, and we've seen this shift in certain European countries, the most recent Germany, towards saying that genetic tests should be ordered under medical supervision. So just to look at the OECD guidelines, there's a whole lot of stuff about laboratory accreditation, proficiency testing, confidentiality of data. Also stuff about information, the laboratory providing information about the test, its scope, its limitations, the accuracy of the test, its significance and its utility. So really this whole issue of regulation by information disclosure is at the heart of the guidelines. The guidelines say that counselling should be offered and the test should be offered within the framework of healthcare. And test results should be reported to referring healthcare professionals, so it may look rather paternalistic. However, it also states that it acknowledges that in some jurisdictions, patients can get test results directly from a laboratory, and also suggests that counselling needs to be proportionate, appropriate to the characteristics of the test, so it doesn't suggest that one size fits all. Now, in relation to the Council of Europe additional protocol on genetic testing, suggests that tests must meet accepted criteria of scientific validity and clinical validity. Again, quality assurance for laboratories, people delivering the test should have appropriate qualifications. Tests should be offered under individualised medical supervision, but you can have exceptions to that. But there shouldn't be any exceptions with regard to genetic tests with important implications for the health of the persons concerned or the family, or concerning procreation choices. Again, counselling should be given in a non-directional manner, but it should be defined according to the implication of the test results. It suggests that predictive tests should require counselling, including tests for susceptibility to common diseases as well as monogenic and carrier testing. So to move on to the situation in the UK, and the UK has been pioneers in regulation of consumer genetics because we had this code of practice in 1997. So I really must stress these are not new issues. We've been talking about this and in fact taking action for a long time. Their kind of list of things that the code of practice covered will be kind of familiar, and I'm sure you can understand what's going on there. In terms of what was acceptable direct to the public, carrier status testing they felt was acceptable, but not most other genetic testing, including genetic components of multifactorial diseases, including tests for somatic mutations. Basically, what happened to this code of practice was the advisory committee was disbanded in a reorganisation of advisory committees on genetics. Responsibilities given to Human Genetics Commission. That was a mistake, because the HGC provides strategic advice to the government and explicitly is not supposed to have a regulatory role. Sciona came along, so HGC said, well, we better review you under the code of practice because you've asked us to. But then they said, well, look, you know, we're not really regulators, so let's have this consultation, Genes Direct and the future of the regulation direct to consumer genetics. The report was published in 2003, a whole slew of recommendations, which I'm probably running out of time to discuss with you, but I'm sure you've all read Genes Direct if you're interested in this area. Pre-market review of tests by MHRA, a code of practice, issues around kind of advertising and independent provision of information. Nothing happened. The government didn't do anything. Perhaps not surprising, because by this point we didn't have any direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies in the UK. Why have a regulatory framework? But by 2006, there were some new companies emerging, like Genostics from Oxford. And that led to renewed activity by HGC. So I was involved in setting up and running a workshop which in 2007, which led to the More Genes Direct report, which essentially reinforced the key recommendations from the original report. One of those recommendations was for a code of practice. And the HGC took the view that this was one thing that it could help to facilitate and move forward, because most of the other things it could just recommend to government. So an international meeting involving lots of industry people, lots of clinicians and ELSI people like myself was convened in the summer of 2008 to discuss the need for a code of practice. Industry all said, yes, let's have a code of practice, that would be great. The regulators like MHRA and the HGC, which isn't a regulator, said, well, we don't want to be responsible for the code of practice, and that issue is still parked. In the meantime, we have drafted guiding principles for a code of practice. They've been approved this month. The draft will be out for consultation in June 2009. It sets out minimum standards for all tests, except for tests for medical research purposes, forensic tests and court-ordered tests for genetic relatedness. And it requires, or it suggests, that certain tests should only be offered with medical supervision. And that's the end of my slides, and that's it.
Thank you very much, Joe.